and welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is John Slick Levengood.
Oh, let me tell you, there was so much slick in this movie, I feel rough by comparison.
I just love that scene where Mel Gibson calls Michelle Pfeiffer slick, and she comes back at him and like, yo, she's like, you never, ever call me slick again.
Which, right, she did not like that. But what's funny is that when we jot down our notes as we watch and prepare for our movie discussions, I think that I wrote the word slick about three other characters before that scene came up.
Oh, listen, this is according to what the creators wanted, this movie is talky, it's brooding, it's sophisticated, it's seductive, it's sexy, it's intelligent, it's incomprehensible, according to one of the main producer, which makes me laugh. But yeah, I mean, this is a stylish, good-looking movie, and the hair on Kurt Russell, and his pinky ring, and his gold watch. I mean, those actually go with the warm tones of this movie. I mean, the production design, costume design is beautiful. But yeah, this is you know what, John, you're right. This is a slick looking production. Absolutely.
It's funny. So watching this, I'm going to say something about a Kurt Russell movie, and I need to give the disclaimer that I mean what I say in the kindest way. Normally I would say something like this in a negative way, but this movie is in fact, in many ways, a bit forgettable. Like, as I was rewatching it a couple times this year, and I know I probably saw it twice, maybe, you know, up to the year 2005. I didn't remember anything about it except that there was something about a ping pong game with a criminal. That's all I remembered. And otherwise, it follows the typical axioms of a kind of slick, not too gritty, but pretty pithy, like 80s, you know, cop movie. It's just that this one is much more manicured and a bit more clever and a bit more thoughtful, and it has more characters that are strong characters than most of those surrounding it in like 5 years in either direction. So this is maybe one of the best of its kind, but at the same time, this kind of movie is a little bit forgettable. And I would not put this in the ranks of like a Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon is what really, I think, you know, cracked out. Although this definitely has all the saxophone music like Lethal Weapon.
Oh my gosh. I wish you get a call and you're Mr. Saxophone, right? You're second runner up for Lost Boys. I mean, you were almost that. And then you get this call and you're like, hey, we're making this movie, Tequila Sunrise, big film. You know, the guy who wrote it, Robert Towne, won an Oscar for Chinatown. The guy who's shooting it, Conrad Hall, is a 10-time Academy Award nominee for cinematography. The costume design, she's been nominated twice for Oscars. Production design, twice nominated. This is a prestige picture. We need you to come in here, John, Saxophone John, and we need you to class up this picture with your saxophone licks. You will be in the studio for at least 7 months. Recording all the saxophone bits in this movie. It's sax heavy.
It is, you know, but I think that if, I don't know if I have the years right. So this came out in 1988. Mm-hmm. When did Lethal Weapon 1 was 87 or 88?
87.
So if they just watch Lethal Weapon 1 like three times in a day, I think they'll get a good beat on when to use the saxophone. Because I think Lethal Weapon was lethal in its saxophone use.
Oh, lethal. Lethal, yeah. The score. Like, I wish there was a thing like lethal saxophone. I mean, saxophones had a good run, John. 85, 86, like 80 Lost Boys, and then Lethal Weapon, and this. At the 25-minute mark of this movie, there is a sax lick that I could have retired on. Like, I would be out with people, like, oh yeah, hey, you know, I worked on the Academy Award winning score for Amadeus. What did you do? Yeah, Tequila Sunrise, saxophone. Like, jaws would drop, right? Italian food would go flying everywhere, because I don't know why, but just that restaurant's beautiful. And people would just be like, okay, cool, I get it, makes sense.
Like a bowl of angel hair gets thrown against the wall and just like slides down like an octopus.
You want to hear something crazy? That restaurant, which was designed by Richard Silbert, who also worked on like Red, Shampoo, Dick, he won an Oscar for Dick Tracy, Chinatown. A restaurant in Los Angeles, a rich restaurateur saw the design in that movie, and he bought the layout from the production. So that is such a beautifully designed set with such warm hues, and the way Michelle Pfeiffer's outfits, you know, match, like the very gray beige outfits match the walls, and this the gold lighting, warm lights, that became a restaurant in L.A. because someone saw that set and went, I want that. So they bought it.
I could see Patrick Bateman and his corporate cohorts having lunch there.
I mean, that's a good looking set, John. And you're right. This is a classy picture. And for me, it's not so much about like memorable moments. It's more about just the vibe, the tone, the swing set scene during Magic Hour that they just randomly caught. There's a look and feel, a lot of fog in this movie, a lot of steam. Lots of foggy rooms. But for me, it's more of like, you know, when you watch a noir movie, and there are very memorable noirs, but you get that tone, that noir tone, like, she came into my office, you know, it was 5 a.m. on a Thursday, sauntering in like she owned the joint. I was hung- yeah. Yes, exactly. I was hungover from a late night. My wife was asking for rent, so I slept outside. Like, you get that mood. Like, this for me is much more of a mood picture than it is a memorable moment. Picture.
But I'm going to come back. It's so interesting how strong even the minor characters are.
Well, like Julia's a revelation. Like, he's an Oscar nominee winner, amazing actor, but I love him in this movie.
But like, so the restaurant staff.
Yeah.
Though, right? Arturo, who, you know, I'll be fine. I got good hands. And then he gets a DUI and everything with him. But that could have been phoned in with any crap actor, and it's really just the device of what's happening and how they're manipulating the legal system. And these minor characters were very strong and like very powerfully delivered. Like they felt like her family. Like you got the sense that this is her family, really. And it's not important to the movie though for that to happen. You just tell us this is her restaurant, and you see that she's running it, and kind of the director and writer did their job. This is swung out of the park.
Yeah, when she's tired at work, her boss comes up to her and is like, hey, you need to go home? And it's not like he's being, like, you know, he puts his arm around her. It's more of like a brother-sister, uncle kind of thing, like looking out for these people. And also, I love the characterization of Raul Julia. I love his speech. I know I'm not saying there's too many memorable moments, but this movie sort of washes over you. But when he's talking to Gibson about, you know, like the way your feelings are, like, is like blaming a compass for pointing north. And he could have been this over the top, murderous, stereotypical drug lord. But instead, he's just opera singing, which they had him do on the fly because they heard him singing off screen. So they just had him singing ping pong playing.
Yeah, that singing was a great characteristic of the. Of that role as well.
And this whole speech about family and
he could have broken into the mamushka.
Yeah.
any moment there.
His whole speech though about family and friends, and it's just refreshing to see a non-stereotypical drug czar. And I will say though that I love what they're going. So this is really interesting. I during my research I learned that they had this movie. The director made a movie called Personal Best, but he was removed during the editing bay. During that deal, Warner Brothers said, we will give you $1 million for a script that you turn in. So he went and he actually went and helped write a movie called Frantic. But during that time, he wrote Tequila Sunrise. Studio loved it. They had Harrison Ford on board. Hey, that rhymes. I love it. And then 2 months before they shot, Harrison Ford dropped out. And then the studio was like, well, hey, can you make the drug dealer bad and the cop good? He's like, no, like the drug dealer's honest. The cop is dishonest, but they're both areas of gray. And they're like, nah, we're not going to do it. So then the producer goes, okay, give us $23 million, drop us down from $33 million, we'll lose $10 million, let us be an independent movie, and we'll make it. And what's interesting, they couldn't find an actor for Kurt Russell. So the director worked with Kurt Russell on Swing Shift. He wrote this with him in mind, Kurt Russell. But Kurt Russell was busy working on other movies, so he couldn't do it. So then they brought in other actors. No one else wanted to be Nick Frescia, because he loses the girl. Mel Gibson gets the girl. Not a lot. It's really interesting, man. A lot of actors, the producer said, did not want to do this because they didn't want to play second fiddle to Mel Gibson. And during an interview I was watching with Kurt Russell, this woman was like, hey, you're acting with Kurt Russell. Were you intimidated? Kurt Russell's been acting since the 50s. And so he's been around long before Mel Gibson was around. I know Mel Gibson has that certain wild card energy. But Kurt Russell goes, no, like, I'm an actor. I'm a good actor. I've been doing this since the 50s. But I thought that was really interesting, man. And it's just such an interesting backstory of how this movie was made. I love the dynamics between these two. But the weakest thing, I don't know if you think about this, but Mel Gibson, he's really able to find a heart with this drug dealer, you know, Dale. But he's just so, like, this is a guy who's been helping cocaine come to the United States for many, many years. He's probably helped, you know, many ODs. He's just a super, he's not a good dude. But in this movie, they're like, he's the honest one. I don't know. I understand the theme of it. But I would say the weakest part for me is even though I understand the idea of it and why they did it, it's just his character. It's like, this dude would not be that. I don't know. I'm not saying drug dealers can't be nice. And I don't know. I just never read his character as, like, real, because he seems almost saint-like to a certain regard. Not saint-like, but I don't know. That's the only thing that read false to me about this movie, is that Mel Gibson's character represented more of an idea than an actual character, even though he's excellent in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you felt that way.
You know, I never thought, as you're saying it, it seems like very aha obvious to me now. But I guess because the movie, other than that, like, I don't know what to call it, faux drug bust in the beginning, drugs are never really in front of us. Mm-hmm. So I don't think about it. We don't see, you know, a bunch of people with guns meeting with briefcases with, again, except
this
for...
This isn't Scarface.
Right. This isn't like a movie... This never feels about a movie. It doesn't feel like a movie that's about a deal that's going down, even though it is. Because this movie is really so much more just about the meetup mm-hmm. being the focus that I guess, I just treat it as it's about trying to catch a criminal using another criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, then... it's just not in the forefront. I'm used to seeing stakes. I'm used to seeing, you know, naked people in some, like, drug den packaging cocaine with people yes, with, you know, yeah. AK-47s walking around, you know, under these, like, you know, black lights. I'm used to people with guns in rooms with other people with guns worried that someone's going to get a hair trigger or get nervous and someone will get killed. So the stakes in this are not until the very, very end, right? And that actually was more a happenstance of just a major moral disagreement between friends, I guess.
Yeah.
But death never feels like a stake. And mm-hmm. we're never presented with people using drugs really, and dealing drugs really. So and now that I'm saying it, it's such a weird angle for a movie that's all about, yeah, these drug dealers and this big bust.
It's like, right? What happens if the guy just got off everything, and, like, if the dude in Blow was able to retire... That's what this movie would be like. And listen, I also know that they originally wanted Mel Gibson to die in this movie because he's just some pawn in the middle of it who gets killed. And they had to reshoot that beach scene at the end to bring him back alive. That's why they tacked that on. I don't need, you know, a lot of people are like, somebody better die to make us feel emotional stakes. I don't really care that much if people die. I'd rather not have a character I like die because I just enjoy the movie. But they wanted him to live at the end of this. So it's just, I guess they didn't need him dying. But I don't know. It just never feels earned at the end because it was obviously tacked on and not written.
I mean, I like the death that we were given, right?
Yeah.
You know, when he turns the gun on Raul Julia, defending himself,
the
right. And he's bleeding out and they're still kind of having a frustrated friends moment, even as he's bleeding out. Right. Like, shut up. I feel sick. No, leave me alone. Like, it's, like, goddamn, you know, like, it, so it's like, even though they're driven to try to kill each other for their other interests, right. Their bigger picture interests, they still care tremendously for each other. So even if Dale, Mel Gibson, doesn't die, he had a tragic loss anyway. Sure, we're going to very quickly pivot our attention to him with Michelle Pfeiffer and some more saxophone music and, you know, what a happy ending, I suppose. But I mean, you know, to the more thoughtful movie viewer who enjoys noticing how many strong characters there are and how powerful the piece is, like, I still felt a great loss when the drug dealer Federale kingpin goes down, like, but it was Mel Gibson's loss, it was Dale's loss that I was feeling.
He's such a good kid. And Raul Julia is such a burst of energy in this
So,
movie.
okay. So I kept thinking about how much I love him in this, and now I know I'm wrong. He carries a very similar gravitas and character acting style in most of his things, you know, much like Jack Nicholson does, right? He has his style, and people want that style. But this and Gomez Adams, and all I keep thinking about those two roles, and I keep thinking, how on earth was Raul Julia never a Bond villain?
Yeah.
He. Exactly this character, practically, or exactly Gomez Adams, without the almost farcical exaggeration. What he brings to the table casually is what most actors need to go full tilt to bring to fine credibility as a Bond villain. I mean, what a great loss that he never was. Like, even now, like maybe for like one of the most recent Daniel Craig, you know, Bonds, if we didn't lose Raul Julia, like if he could have just been that villain, how cool would that have been?
I guess the closest we got was Bison because he's like a megalomaniac, megalo, wait, megalom, my brain is
Megalomaniac?
megalomaniac
Megalomaniacal person?
wants to, yeah, who wants to take over the world and have Bison Bucks in his own villa. So at least we
Bison
got that.
Bucks.
But it would have been nice to see him in a prestige Sam Mendes Bond film. Just it's, but his alive presence and. You know, at the end, he's right. I mean, this is 88. I mean, everyone knows 88, the 80s for cocaine. But then the 90s, think about all like the weed explosion that were there, like just between like music and movies and Half Baked and even like True Romance films before that. So he was actually pretty right about weed becoming the next.
Future is grass, my
I got some
friend.
Thai stick coming in. Like, and he's right. That's which, but I just love how unrepentant he is. I like the friendship that they have. And that's another reason why I do like this movie. But I also, I know that a lot of people, you know, it's not rated well in Rotten Tomatoes. It's 52% and 40%. The audience score is lower than the critical score. But I think at the time, both these actors had so much heat on them. And it's just more contemplative. It's just some, it's good to look at. There's conversations. And it doesn't really give you everything on a plate, too. It doesn't just say, here it all is. Like, you have to watch it. You have to kind of soak up in it. So I can see why audiences don't dig it that much, but it's always nice to have a friendship explored. But see, I don't think they spent enough time with Russell and Gibson's friendship. That's why I bought into Julia's, or you know, I guess I should say his name, you know, Carlos and Dale's relationship, because they're together a lot. You see their dynamic. So I was much more invested in them than I was with Nick and Dale.
And even their phone calls in the
Yeah.
beginning. So, like, normally those scenes, even when you hear, well, you know, I honestly, in the 80s, for some reason, most of the time someone was on the phone, you only saw the person reacting to what they were saying. Right? I don't know why that is. Whereas here you get to hear Raul Julia, which feels like more contemporary for its time. But usually phone calls, they're just like they're pivots, they're flag posts for the writer and director to let you know where the movie's going almost. Whereas their phone calls were
Yeah,
great.
they were.
Like, we're talking about ping pong. It's like, look, Carlos, I don't even think you should come down here. Carlos insists on speaking Spanish the whole time, right? Dale is clearly understanding and responding casually in English, which makes sense because he's on a street in America. If anyone walks by, right, that would be unusual to see someone who looks like Mel Gibson speaking Spanish probably back then. So he's speaking English back. And he's like, look, I think there's too much heat here. You shouldn't even come. He's like, come on, of course I'm coming. Just you have to make it work. But chingado, can you just give me 7 points, do you think, when we play? It's like, I don't think there's gonna be time for ping pong. There's always time. Like that, like th this conversation that they're having, it's like your best bud is coming into town for the weekend, but now you're married and have kids. It's like, look, I don't know if I'm gonna, oh, like just come on. Like, it just feels like this heckling where he knows he's gonna get him out,
Yeah.
you know? And meanwhile, there are real stakes, and I'm just reacting more to just how kind of, I don't know, cute this clear, long-standing bromance they have, even though it stems from protecting each other in a Mexican prison, like, you know, 20 years prior. There's so many interesting plot inklings that get dropped in our lap, and they don't need to be explored, right? But there's so many what I'll call just little little like pinches of flavor thrown into this stew that most movies don't have the pleasure of enjoying. Like, mm-hmm. this is getting Inception level plot attention for the kind of movie that's normally like, and then Steven Seagal throat chops 8 guys, cue the saxophone music, sex with Kelly LeBrock, satin sheets, and they wake up. He's like, sorry, honey, I got to go kill 8 more people.
Yeah.
You know, those are the movies that normally we expect for these cop movies with the saxophone music and the smoky scenes, whether it's from a hot tub or the temperature change and the heat rising at dusk or, you know, some steam vent in an alley, right? So it's funny how this seems to be coloring by all the numbers of the movies around it, but this one is using an artist's easel, and it's doing it at the top of a chapel instead of, you know, watercolors at an IHOP on a placemat.
I mean, you can tell that this is the director also wrote the movie. So Robert Towne, he's already an Oscar winner for Chinatown. This is a guy who... And you know what's interesting? By cutting the $10 million off this, he got pretty much full control to, I mean, aside from the reshooting of the ending, but he got full control to make what the producer, in the producer's words, he's like, you know, it's kind of incomprehensible. Like, it makes sense, but it's more about the characters, the emotions, their relationships, their feelings. And that's what I love about it. It's just an unvarnished screenplay that plays out on screen. I mean, there's some great lines too. Like, I'm like my men drinking scotch and bourbon as opposed to vodka, because I like people to know when they're drunk. There's mm-hmm. some they're drunk and not stupid. There's some neat lines in this. And also, too, I mean, just the look of this movie. On rewatch, the cinematography by Conrad Hall it's never flashy. Right. It's never super, you know, camera spinning around in circles. It's not, you know, Crank putting a GoPro on Jason Statham and making him run. But every shot is just so classy. And there are scenes with Kurt Russell where he'll be lying to a character and half of his face is shadowed. There are these beautiful warm lights inside of the restaurant and Mel Gibson's apartment. Just the cool light coming in. And I don't know how they did it, but they're on set. And there's a scene where T.J. Walsh, J.T. Walsh is talking, and it's artificial light hitting him because he's in a studio, but it doesn't look like artificial light. And they reunited for Breakdown later on, him and Russell. But it's beautifully shot. I mean, just the shadows. And like I said again, a 10-time Oscar nominee shot this. But it's just, man, it's such a sumptuous looking movie. And even the sweater that Mel Gibson wears in this movie, it matches the color palette of the film. Like, you see Michelle Pfeiffer wearing beige, and then there's a beige wall behind her. She blends in with that. When she has a scene where, you know, you get angry and you express yourself, she's wearing black. It's just a very well thought out costume design shot movie. And it's weird because it's so drenched in daylight, a lot of it, that I don't know, it gave me such a different vibe, and I really thought they captured the area well. And I don't know why, I know this doesn't have to go with what we were talking about, but you just want to like soak yourself up in this movie. Like, you just want to, I mean, pour yourself a glass of what? Herradura, which they got a huge contract for, and Mel Gibson just mentions it. And then do a nice tequila sunrise, which is what? Orange juice and tequila? Jeez Louise. And some cherry, orange slice.
Is that all it is? There's not like pineapple juice in there too?
And a highball glass. Well, so I'm reading a recipe here by Jeffrey Zacharian. And it's in a highball glass filled with ice, pour in the tequila and orange juice. Slowly pour the grenadine into the glass over the back of a spoon or by drizzling it down the side of the glass, allowing it to settle at the bottom. Garnish it with an orange slice and a maraschino cherry. Or if you're watching Slammin' Salmon, a Marciano cherry.
Oh, Barca's Rocky Marciano.
Whatever. I love Michael Clark Duncan in that movie. But I guess you just want to soak up in this movie. And I like that it's not flashy, but the more you look at the shots of this film, and there's a scene on the beach where Mel Gibson goes after his son and Michelle Pfeiffer turns around. The framing of that is just beautiful. This cinematographer, he just knows how to frame a shot. He knows foreground. He knows background. The scene on the stairs with Julia and Gibson, where you have the stairs drenched, and then when they're talking, Gibson's kind of in the light, and Raul Julia is kind of bathed in shadows. It's just, it's pretty awesome, man. As far as a film nerd and like someone who loves lighting and who teaches lighting, this was like a masterclass to me. But I think a lot of people don't notice it because it's not like The Revenant with like one take shots. Like, it's just classy.
Well, and when I watch this, though, even though it's so good, it feels like something that could be watched very casually again. Yeah. It just, so it's like, if you weren't paying close attention, you wouldn't realize how nuanced the plot was, but really it's still moving in the same direction. So it almost doesn't matter that you weren't paying attention. You're just missing a lot, but you're not going to be confused.
No.
You know,
the cop, drug dealer, friends, girl in the middle. Drug dealer comes to town. She gets caught in the middle of it. They have to make decisions. It's simple, but it's not. But it's good though, right? It's a hangout picture, but it's also one you can get immersed in.
Yeah,
like Knight's Tale.
This is like the more attention you pay, the better your payoff will be. But the less attention you pay, you're not punished for.
You know what? I want a director's cut, John, where every time the sax is on, the camera just pans and there's just a guy playing saxophone.
Right, it pans to the right and you actually see the guy playing the saxophone just offset. And in the background, it's the craft services table, like right there. And there's just someone holding a boom in front of the saxophone.
just wailing away.
You know what's funny? Pants. Wait, so the hot tub sex scene, right?
Oh, yeah.
So there's the hot tub sex scene. And you notice that there are these, like, these not satin, these, like, lacy sheets kind of, like, waving in the air. And so then when you pan just to the right to see the offset saxophone player, you also see the production assistants shaking the sheets that are waving in front of the camera like they're fanning a sultan.
Someone has a fan, the other one has that, right. Just working it off. I want a movie that it's just a total movie like that, but then it cuts to these behind the scenes shots and never explains it. It's right. Just straight laced. Oh my gosh. All right, so how about this? Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about Kurt Russell in this movie, because this is the theme. We cover him every 25th movie.
Is he in this movie?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to dive into Kurt Russell. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And John, I was listening to an interview with Kurt Russell, and he said he really wanted this role because it's the first time he's ever worn a suit in a movie. Which made me laugh because, I mean, yeah, like, so, like a proper suit. So
no, as opposed to his baby blue suit when he was undercover in the whorehouse in Big Trouble in Little China.
I think he's talking about more like a stylish. He's not used carring it. He's not.
I liked his polyester used car suits.
But you know what I mean? Like, he's stylish. I do. So he modeled his performance after Pat Riley, his look after Pat Riley, the New York Knicks coach with his slick back hair and all of that. But I just think this was a different type of Kurt, because if you know, obviously he was a child actor and then he had used cars, but in used cars he was like a huckster. He would sell you a used car, lie about it, get you driving a mile down the road and it breaks down. Like, he's a salesman. He's just a larger than life ball of energy. And then we've also talked about Escape from New York. He's basically Clint Eastwood, right? But Snake. Then we also have The Thing, where he is more talkative, but he's more sullen. He's kind of a survivor. He's a pragmatist. He keeps his head on his shoulders. And then we also get into what Sling Shift, where he's kind of like a rakish World War II-esque guy. Mean Season, this the football player, larger than life. Big Trouble in Little China, just a total dork. Overboard.
Which has no idea he's a dork.
Yeah, exactly. Overboard, just a boisterous construction worker, family man with a heart of gold.
Another hustler, though.
Yeah, exactly. Total hustler. So, yeah. I mean, he's a hustler in this one, too, Tequila Sunrise, but he's more slick. Hey.
In the other ones, he's hustling because his life is the hustle. In this, he's gaming a system, right?
There it is.
And yeah, they're all hustlers, but he's tactfully gaming something in this. And everybody is. Everybody is. This whole movie is like actively shuffling cards with who's distrusting who and who's now trusting who, who's turning on who, who's double crossing on who constantly. And yeah, he's seriously an ace in that deck. Cause he even aims JT Walsh's character at Dale, Mel Gibson's character, inadvertently in the end to get him to try and kill him.
Yeah, so he's gaming the system. He But I love seeing this kind of Russell, because yes, he loses the woman to Mel Gibson, but he also lies to her. Like, he also did set her up. Like, he played her. And so I don't know, I like this. I would say this is the first slick. In Used Cars, he's not slick.
Right.
I mean, he's sandpaper.
He wants to be slick. He thinks he's slick, but he is, yeah. Right?
He's smooth sandpaper. Sandpaper with delusions of grandeur. Right. Snake Plissken, rough around the edges, but it's fun. Silkwood, he's very much so like the husband in this. He's good, but he's more of like the caring. This one's just like hair slicked back, pinky ring, Rolex, sweet looking suits, great Cadillac, just rolling, playing the system, flipping. So in the commentary, he walked in, flipped the system, went after JT Walsh, flipped the coffee, went after JT Walsh. JT Walsh comes in to apologize. Like, he sets stuff up. He sees this kind of stuff, which I love. Like, he's the one that figures out about Carlos. But I like seeing this kind of Russell, because we don't see this much of, like, Captain Ron, no. Backdraft, no. Tango and Cash, no. Tombstone, Stargate, no. Executive Decision, he's kind of dorky. Not a dork. He's a suit brought up
right.
to fly a plane. Breakdown, Everyday Guy, Soldier Badass. He's never done, like, so he played a cop in Dark Blue, completely different cop. He's never been, maybe the closest I would say to this character is Mr. Nobody in Furious 7.
I was waiting to chime it, yeah.
Right? Because very slick, very, he has the Corona in advance, the same hair. He's just a slick, so he's been slick. Would you say he's been slick twice in his career?
It's not much. That's probably it.
Yeah, right? We just went through it.
That's really probably it. Uh-huh.
But it's interesting, though. I mean, when you think about Kurt Russell, he doesn't do the method acting, right? He's not going Daniel Day-Lewis. He's not going Christian Bale. But he does have a bunch of different characters. He does have a good range to him. But I don't know. I liked – and also, too – I actually have a lot more respect for – I've always had respect for him. I don't know how I could have more respect for him. Maybe I just make 10 louder. But it's – people didn't want this role, John. People turned down this role because I don't want to lose the girl. Like, that's – and he didn't care. He just takes it. He wanted a challenge. He wanted to look slick. But that's what makes me like him more. It's unselfish, this role.
Yeah, maybe part of the reason it's so contested is that – again, about that role, is that there were quite a few established actors who had a lot of screen time in this.
Yeah.
Right. So when your opposition is, Mad Max and Lieutenant Riggs, right? Already very famous, right?
Yep.
Very famous. And,
Michelle Pfeiffer had been crushing it.
Scarface's main squeeze, right? She's mm-hmm. been around. Wait, like, I'm the character who loses Michelle Pfeiffer. I'm the character who gets beat by Mel Gibson, but I'm not some nobody where this is the big opportunity for me. And so, like, there's a lot on screen here. There's a lot of star power for this kind of movie on screen. So I can see that. I can see someone being nervous or apprehensive or overthinking what other people will think of the movie, whereas then you just have us. It's like, I'm just so happy that you were all here.
Yeah,
it's like, you guys are all great.
I don't want to be on screen, but that always blows my mind, John, because you're like, hey, Mark, the guy who wrote Chinatown is directing a movie, and he has casted Michelle Pfeiffer, Lady Hawks, Scarface, the Witches of Eastwick, mm-hmm. Michelle Pfeiffer, and Mad Max himself. And we also have J.T. Walt. We have Raul Julia, Academy Award nominated actor Raul Julia. Do you want to be in it? Yeah. And also our cinematographer has won 10 Oscars. Like, do you want to do, like, it blows my mind sometimes how people like, I don't want this role because I don't want to look bad. I don't want to lose. But I don't know. I'd rather be in a great film with a great squad than be, I don't know. There's a lot of ego in this.
I'd rather do a great job at losing.
Yeah, exactly.
Then phone it in winning.
Yeah, and I don't know. That's just what I like about this. And where do you think this ranks amongst his best performances? Would you say it's, Is it, okay, I'm giving you a chart, right? There's three levels to it. There is iconic,
low,
underappreciated. Oh, wait, okay, three levels. Okay, get 1 out of 10. Where does this rank? Like, for his performance, I'm messing up here, but like, so this isn't one of his worst roles, right? This is, I don't think he's really had many terrible roles in movies, but I wouldn't say it's one of his more iconic roles, but he bites into some good stuff here, and he does some very good act in this.
I think it's almost absence of iconic.
Yeah.
Right. This kind of role. It's almost like how I feel about the movie, though. Like, I can watch this movie and love this movie, but in another 5 years, I'm hardly going to remember this movie again, probably, mm-hmm. unless I keep watching it, right? There's something about it that, again, this is this kind of thing that normally isn't done that well, but in this case, it was just done magnificently.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not Snake. It's not.
Yeah, there's nothing iconic, really, for me anyway, right? Nothing sticks. Nothing is going to – I'm not going to remember in 5 years when I'm talking about Kurt Russell. I'm not going to remember much about this character unless we're just talking about his range. And I'll be like, well, yeah, and he was in Tequila Sunrise, and that's probably going to be my contribution. Like, for like when we're – like when I'm adding weird things that he's done. No, this isn't iconic for me, but it, underappreciated. I mean, this is a role that's worthy of tremendous appreciation, I think.
Yeah.
I think this is a really cool role. And then I guess, you know, so if I was an acting critic, maybe all of a sudden this would be iconic, but I'm not an acting critic. So to me, it's not iconic.
I think he's happy blending in. He's happy being a team player on this. And that I think that he's in Captain Ron, man, he is chewing scenery. In Escape from New York, he's just the epitome of like a sassy badass. So I do think that I think he took this role knowing that it was kind of a challenge for him. He got to look slick. And he was happy. You know, for me, this movie is much more about Robert Towne than it is about Mel Gibson, Michelle Pfeiffer, or Kurt Russell. I mean, this is about his writing and direct for me. So, you know, when there's a movie, you watch a movie and you're kind of, oh, that's a Quentin Tarantino movie. You don't really think about, I mean, some performances really do stand out, but there are movies where it's like auteur driven, like a Wes Anderson film. And so for me, this is more about the writer director than it is about the performances. But I guess if I had to rate this, yeah, I couldn't put it up there with his most iconic, but I also think he's doing something much different here, and there's a lack of – he's not really – I don't know. I would put this top 33%. Does that make sense?
Of his roles?
Yeah.
Of acting quality or
yeah, just acting how quality.
So acting quality, I probably couldn't deny that. For impact on me, it's going to
oh,
be
– Oh, yeah, yeah. Good, yeah.
Very
good.
Low, right?
That's a good point. The pinky ring,
though. It's so weird to say, because even when we use words like impact, there's so much sophistry and context involved. Because, again, watching this, everybody on screen all the time is impacting me tremendously. But it's more like in this kind of movie, I don't expect this. And Kurt Russell might have been acting for a long time, but as a mature adult, he didn't. Well, he might have been the most experienced actor out of our mains,
yeah, been
really.
Around since the 50s.
But when we think of these actors, we think of them like now, like this is them as kids.
Yeah.
Acting, and you look at the quality that's coming out of it. Like it's tremendous. I mean, you go back and look at The Rock back in The Rundown, and I want to be clear, I love The Rock and I love The Rundown. But even his own grasp of his own smolder and charisma was, I almost want to call it prepubescent to the grip that he has on it now. He was working on it in his whole wrestling career too. It's just that back then it was for flair and you know, exaggeration. And even though he still has exaggerated roles, he's honed it. And so when I look at these people when they're younger, I expect them not to be so honed. But Michelle Pfeiffer, Mel Gibson, and Russell, they all – you could have replaced them with 50-year-old versions of themselves, and I expect the same level of performance.
Absolutely.
It's really – so, yeah, so there's so much impact in that. It's just that I need to discuss it to find the impact. But it's there.
One of my favorite moments with him is when he gives that long explanation when they're at the restaurant. He walks in with Michelle Pfeiffer to Raul Julia. I get Carlos or Escalante. And he gives this long-winded thing that is just clearly BS. And then Carlos goes, Escalante is like, that was a long explanation for something not important. And I think that's where Kurt Russell shines, is giving long explanations to things that aren't important. Like, that's his salesman. But it was so unconvincing in this one. Like, I feel like used cars Rudy could have pulled that off, but this character flaw, like, he's Mr. Slickster, slick again, but he did not pull that off. And I thought that was really neat. That was like one of my favorite moments, because we've all witnessed that before, where people just give something, you're like, ooh, like, hey, what are you doing? Oh, well, nothing, squirrel ran in here and I had to run around with a bag and then I was doing this and like, wait, what? Like, just, that was overly long, just, I don't know, just tell the truth. But I love that moment with him. It was good.
Yeah, Raul Julia, though, he's just like, I feel like Kurt Russell was a hobbit in front of the Smaug's treasure hoard there, and Raul Julia is the dragon. Like, he just sits, and Raul Julia, as he's hearing that explanation, you could just feel his eyes piercing Kurt Russell's flesh, like looking right through him the whole time, like a stare.
And then just I think there's also a nice kind of insecurity to his character, right? Where, you know, at that time, man, Mel Gibson had it. Like, Mel Gibson, just that wild card persona. He had that, you know, just when you watch him, what he does with his eyes and like the way he kind of talk, like his performance. Like, I think his character, Nick, knows that Dale is the more appealing of the two. I got that vibe from them. And I don't know. I like that as well. There's like this weird competitiveness, but it mainly seems with him. He seems more competitive with Dale than Dale does with him.
Yeah. Dale's just going about his business. Yeah. And right.
Yeah.
And Nick is finding his own competition.
Yeah, exactly. But it's cool, man. Like, that's, but this movie doesn't tell you that. Like, we're, I don't know. It's good. There's so many monologues. I keep saying it's good. It's good. And I wish I had a more articulate way to frame this film, but it's just, I think the low ratings on both the audience and critic are because I don't think people are expecting this, because Tango and Cash, if you look at 88 cinema, this was not the norm. So I think people watching this did not exactly get what they wanted from this movie. And that's maybe why I think, because there's no major gunfights. I mean, the standoff between Russell and Mel Gibson, they're holding their guns like right in front of them. Right. It's not, I want to do the standoff from the 80s and 90s. Because in the 90s with John Woo, it became about outstretched arms pointing at each other, but in this one, they're kind of crooked, kind of pointing at each other, which I love. But yeah, there's the explosions aren't too impressive. It's just a slick production that doesn't really give people what they wanted, I think. So,
you know, again, so much great dialogue, though, and that's the last thing you expect in this kind of movie. I think it's even the last thing that people think that they want when they watch this kind of movie. So when you go see the gritty cop crime movie in 1988, and you're getting all of this really clever, longer-winded dialogue. You know, it's like you thought you were going for Michael Bay, and you got The Remains of the Day. I mean, not really that, but I mean, because so you're talking about the long line that he had in front of Raul Julia. But what about when Kurt Russell was pouring himself rather sincerely at the restaurant? But not in the wine cellar.
With his black sweater on, framed really well.
Right, and he's like, look, this is what I did to you, and this is why I did it. But these are the things that I really found that I feel despite that, and here are the things that I'm trying to do at work, but I actually do care about Dale, but I do care about busting this thing, and I don't know where I fall, where I should fall when all these cards hit the floor, but these are all of my independent drives, and I don't know what to do. I just know that I'm here, and I'm sorry you feel this way, and I'm trying to tell you what I'm doing and why I did it. So you get me, right? Like, it's something like that. But it was long. Like, he really laid out, like, all his cards.
That's why you take these roles, right? Because he got the monologue, and a good monologue. A smart monologue.
It's a good monologue.
And a well-framed monologue while wearing a sweet sweater. That's why you take it.
It's also it's not an exposition dump, because all that stuff has been presented to us, but it is a good flag posting exposition reminder for the audience, but done in a very like value added way.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's so many good monologues in this movie.
And yet again, though, this is the kind of movie where people don't expect that. They don't really need that. So I don't really think they're going to notice that or appreciate that.
All right. I'm glad we talked about this. This was kind of, I'm glad we got in a new Russell territory. And I'm going to pitch a movie to you next.
Uh-oh. Okay.
We had a couple options, but I'm going to pull a big one on you here.
Big one?
A big one. Executive Decision.
Oh, you see, I thought, I assumed because they got mentioned it was going to be that or Breakdown.
What do you think?
I'm I'm all over it. Executive decision all the way. And that's another movie which I've seen, I won't say a whole lot, but I've seen it many, several times from start to finish, like his dedicated viewings in the late 90s and early 2000s. This is like a 97 movie, I think, right? About that.
Yeah, thereabouts. It came out after Escape from L.A.
Right. So I think I saw it a couple times like in high school when it came out. I'm sure I saw it in theaters. I probably saw it once or twice in college. And then I probably haven't seen it in basically 20 years. So it'll be interesting to revisit that. Like if I've seen 20 minutes of that movie in the last 20 years, it was like folding laundry, you know, and it was on like HBO 8.
So it's 96.
96. There we go. Yeah. So I had all of high school for that, basically, to watch that.
And this is insane. The IMDb score for Executive Decision is 6.4. The Tomato Meter score is 65. And the Metacritic score is 62. So universally, with critics and ratings, it's a 65% movie, which blows my mind. Because I can't find any more pure joy than watching Joe Morton and Oliver Platt use a straw to block a bomb. Or watching John Leguizamo be a badass.
That is a great cast.
Great cast. That too. Cast. And then also, I didn't know Seagal was going to die.
At the time, I went to see that to see a Steven Seagal movie. Yeah. I mean, I liked a lot of people in the cast. But in 96, Oliver Platt, I mean, I knew who he was, right, because of Flatliners. But I wasn't so movie savvy for that to be fluent in my mind. For me, Oliver Platt became someone who I loved with Lake Placid, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's so good. All right, so I want to do something real quick. I just want to give listeners an overall screenshot of a listening of 1988. So let's you and I do a 1988 draft. No rules, no Die Hard.
No rules, no Die Hard.
Yeah, one rule, no Die Hard. I think that's fair because it doesn't matter who you have. If you take Die Hard, you've won. So
Maybe.
I'll give you first pick, John. But you know me, I pick my like Desert Island 88 movies. I don't really ever go to win.
I'm going to go Beetlejuice.
Ooh. All right, I'll take Willow.
Ooh. God, I almost feel like I made the wrong pick.
Do you want to rewind it?
No. It's such a interesting
I had to do it. You know me, man. I love that movie. I've covered this on the pod. It's just a beautiful movie. So I'm going to take that.
1988. Okay, wait. Was Lethal Weapon 1 1988?
I thought it was 87.
I don't know if I want to pick Lethal Weapon 2. I mean, I love Lethal Weapon 2, but with all the South Africans, it just wasn't, you know, the same. I believe that was the year of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4.
Yep. Noe's 4.
I'm going to take Noe's 4. We've covered that, by the way, listeners. You should go check that out.
Great episode. All right. So, man. Okay. Don't kill me, John. But you know how much I adore this movie, They Live.
Okay, no, good choice. That was on, it's on a short list, but I don't feel like we need to have an 8-minute fight with 8 hits in the balls to battle over that movie. I submit to you. You can have.
And you know I love it. I'm not going for like, you know I adore that movie. All right, what's your third pick?
88. Boy. I mean, this isn't easy. I'm going to go with Phantasm 2.
Whoa. All right.
Not surprisingly, I'm very horror-driven because that's just where most of my comfort zone is.
All right. Since you took a bonker pick, I'm going to take Red Scorpion because you know why.
Oh, Dolph Lundgren.
Yep.
I used to own that VHS. I still remember early when he's in this prison cell or whatever, and someone comes in and he kind of gets up and does what I'll call like a to the stomach roundhouse as he's standing up. And the guy just like flies through the doorway. And at the time, I just thought this is the most awesome thing ever. What an interesting pick. Okay. All right. So
I can't, you know, you took that. So I'm not going to pick another big gun.
Most of the Rockies that I like are way earlier. So, okay. I'm going to go Child's Play.
Ooh, Child's Play. There's so many good movies left on here. You know what? I got to do it. Coming to America.
All right. I think I'm going to veer away from horror for one pick. Twins.
Oh, that's huge. That's a good
one. I adore that movie. And it's an Arnold movie, and I love Arnold. I'm literally drinking out of an Arnold Schwarzenegger beer glass right now.
Oh, man. All right. So this is tough. I hate having a last pick, John, because there's so many good ones left
here. This is like the coup de grace, like, though. Oh, my God. Oh, did I...
There's fish called God. Wanda. Oh, do you want to add one?
No,
I think
no,
I know I what you my, want. I think I know.
I made my choice. I made my choice. You, but Mark, do you want Bloodsport?
Is that what you want?
Yeah, dude, take Bloodsport.
No, I don't want it. I don't want it.
It deserves to be in this.
Well, I'll let you have it. Do you want to drop? No, what do you want? Phantasm 2 for Bloodsport? Do it. Drop one. Twins, come on.
Though. You know, I should take Bloodsport instead of Twins then. If you're really going to give me a mulligan here.
John, I love it. I just love competing. I'll lose. I'll happily lose. I want you to
I'm
going to
do Bloodsport. But now do you want a mulligan because you gave me a mulligan?
Well, I'll just pick six. So I'll just pick two more.
Ooh, okay.
Is that fair?
That's fair. You gave me a mulligan. You can pick two more.
Okay, so I'll take Ernest Saves Christmas as a crazy pick.
That was 88, huh?
Ernest Saves Christmas.
Not when was Camp?
The year before? Had to have been, because this is the second one. Okay, all right, so I have that. I'm not going to do Above the Law. Halloween 4, Overboard. Okay, we got to get out of here. I am going to... Naked Gun? Naked Gun?
Oh, wow, okay.
A Fish Called Wanda, Kevin Kline got his Oscar.
That's a great movie. Great, great movie. Oh, my God, the remake Young of Guns? The Blob was from 88.
Yeah, Young Guns is in here. Broadcast News, one of my favorite movies.
Oh my
Great
God,
Outdoors, a bear got shot in the butt.
There's The Blob and Pumpkinhead. I love Pumpkinhead.
All right, I'm gonna let you decide this, John. A Fish Called Wanda or Naked Gun? You can. Which one should I pick?
So, well, I loved the Naked Gun back then, but for me, A Fish Called Wanda holds much better.
All right, I'll take Fish because Kevin Kline won a comedy for an Oscar for a comedy. I was gonna say for an Oscar. So yeah, you have Beetlejuice, Nose 4, Phantasm 2, Child's Play, Twins, and Bloodsport. I have Willow, They Live, Red Scorpion, Coming to America, Ernest Saves Christmas, and A Fish Called Wanda. Now, we left out Good Morning Vietnam. We left out Big, but I'm happy. I'm very happy.
And Big was eight. I don't know why I thought Big was older than that, but I'm comfortable leaving out
Bull
Big.
Durham. I'm going to write, though, like who put together the best 1988 squad without Die Hard. Because you know somebody will be like, there's no Die Hard. John... Die Hard is, man, that's in a list. That, Dark Knight, Tommy Boy, Event Horizon. But yeah, this was fun, and thank you for joining me. And I look forward to doing Executive Decision next, where it's a brand new kind of wrestle.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a Seagal series, it's the same Seagal. I mean, it's always, he's just awesome. So I had to rewatch a lot of his movies. There's a video coming out soon for JCVD versus Seagal. And I watched all of his final fights, and he just pulverizes people, John.
Whereas Van Damme always pulverized but ends up winning.
Exactly. What I like about Van Damme is that he has a very sensitive side, and he's not afraid to get shellacked and lose. Kickboxer and all these movies, he's not afraid to... Earlier in his career, he had a side to him where he could get beat up. And that's really... I actually appreciated that a lot about his films. But John, tell people about your Twitter. Tell people about your reviews before we get out of here.
Oh, dear. I mean, I'm John's Horror Corner basically anywhere you look. So you look for John's Horror Corner on Twitter or Instagram, or I don't have a whole lot of content on Pinterest, please enjoy my beer and movie pairings.
That's my favorite thing you do.
Pinterest.
Well, I love all I love your reviews. I love, you have a huge Twitter following, but I love your pairings because they're so creative and they put a lot of thought and you always frame it well. I always look forward to your pairings. You did an Australian one because of Mel Gibson.
Right.
With
Which
this.
I don't know if most people even realize when they see it.
But that's deep cuts. You got Megan and I were both really happy to be like, oh, Australia, Mel Gibson. So that's my favorite. I love your pictures on Instagram. So
You know, for a big Jersey Italian with tattoos who lives in the gym, that is the one way that I have figured out Instagram is my beer and movie pairings. That's what gets all the attention. If I put up a review, people are like, oh, my three best friends will like it. You know? When I put up a beer pairing, it's like, boom, 50 people I never heard of.
Because it's great, man. I love that. It's a really neat angle you got. I love it.
It is the equivalent of girls taking pictures of their food. I've just found my mastery.
Or us. Yeah. All right, well, hey, follow him on Instagram and Twitter. Head to Movies, Films, and Flicks. Check out John's Horror Corner. Check out all the stuff that John does. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me, John.
Absolutely.
This is a real slick episode. This is a good one. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for John Pinky Ring Levengood, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.